Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
This episode is about how people do not have the ability to understand the world without capitalism. They fail to see obvious solutions to basic things because they can't operate without a profit motive. A prime example of this is grocery stores. How often do you go to the grocery store and you're in one grocery store, and as you're walking out, you can see another grocery store? There's absolutely no reason to have two grocery stores next to each other because they sell identical products at identical prices. And this identical prices phenomenon was actually investigated by the Federal Trade Commission in 1972, where they accused four food manufacturers of illegally monopolizing the market for breakfast cereals and thus forcing consumers to pay artificially inflated prices for products. So the FTC literally accused the four major cereal companies. I think it was Kellogg's, General Mills, Quaker Oats, and the General Foods Corporation, which manufactures Post cereals. So that was in 1972. And then 10 years later, in 1982, when Reagan was president, the composition of the FTC was composed of three Republicans and one Democrat, and they voted to dismiss the appeal along partisan lines. So it was a 3-1 vote, and this price fixing of cereal got thrown away. In the opinion for the appeal, and this is where we start to see the big, beautiful, incredible rise in neoliberalism, if the commission had found a violation, it is unlikely that the Federal Trade Commission could restructure any industry without a clear congressional mandate. So we can't have nice things unless Congress tells us to, even though it very clearly would be in the best interest of everybody involved. We have to have capitalism unless Congress says we don't.
Not fucking nuts.
So it's an absolutely wild conclusion. And the point of this story is to establish that in the last 40 years, the entire U.S. mindset has been an unquestioning regard for capitalism's existence. And people in the highest levels of stuff like the Federal Trade Commission cannot envision a world in which it doesn't exist. And they're incapable of enacting policy without capitalism existing. So it's unsurprising that the layperson in the United States has their mind melted when we talk about basic problems of capitalism and they're reflexively defending its existence.
And this starts off the whole name of the podcast as Post-Capitalism Stress Disorder. And it's like PTSD, in which every single time you try to envision the world without what you already know, you panic. Because you just can't understand what it would be like to not be able to go to like 15 grocery stores to get your coupons. Because it's just fundamentally not something that you can do. And this is primarily because you have never seen, and by you I mean literally everybody listening to this, have never seen a world in which you don't have capitalism or neoliberalism driving something. And this is what the stress is, because if you sit down and think about, I have a house that I own, and it's private, and I go to work every day, and my boss tells me what I should be doing, and I get my money at the end of the day, or week, or whatever it is, and I go to the grocery store, and I buy my food, my kids go to school, and all the things that your life is, you can't envision what it would be like for you not to have to go to work, or be forced into debt servitude, or pay for college with student loans, or go to the doctor whenever you want to without needing to pay for it. Like, it's fundamentally stressful to think about how you could change fundamentally how you're living. And this is why boomers and everybody in the Gen X are so resistant to things that Bernie say. Because they work their entire lives underneath the stresses of capitalism. And when you talk about taking away what they fought for, it causes them anxiety. Think about somebody who has worked 40 years to get a pension and you're telling them that, guess what, we're going to fundamentally change the entire economy so you don't actually have to work. Think about the assholes out there that say things like, well, they want to get rid of student debt. I paid off my student loan. Why? What, should I get a rebate? Like, that's the reactionary thing that happens, because they can't empathize with individuals who will never pay off the student loans because they took out $85,000 and never graduated college because it was too stressful, because they had some misfortune happen. And that's fundamentally what PCSD is, or post-capitalism stress disorder, is how would the world beyond capitalism caused me to live. I have no idea what it looks like. Ah, panic.
Yeah, it's resistance to change.
Exactly. Absolutely. And they don't know what it looks like. It'd be similar to you saying that, like, I don't even know any good example, because they're all basically based on capitalism. I mean, if you said fundamentally you're not going to be able to drink milk anymore, some people would panic because they want to drink milk. You can't eat meat anymore. Why? Because you got bit by the Lone Star tick and now you have the antibodies that cause you to get allergic reaction to red meat. That would cause a fundamental brain, like, destruction for anybody who loved red meat, because they don't know what it's like to live without it. Think about the transition away from cable TV. How long that's been. There are people now who don't know what it's like to not have certain shows at the touch of a button. But there, at one point in time, there was people who didn't know what it was like to not have, like, the TV on in the background, the commercials playing. And guess what? If you go to a lot of the places that handle the elderly, you know, populations, there's a TV on with commercials and shit playing because that's what they know. They don't want to stream a Netflix or whatever it is, or Hulu. Anyways, PCSD, it's a real thing. It is something that, you know, you should keep in mind as you think about every part of your life and the change is going to have to happen in order for us to get past capitalism.
So in the mid-2000s, Canada incurred a bread price-fixing scandal that involved the Loblaw grocery store chain and McKinsey, which is a American contractor. And Peter Butterbar, presidential candidate, current transportation secretary, worked for Loblaw, and this is what his campaign said about his employment. He was part of a team that ran analytics and put together a model to help the supermarket chain determine how much and in what stores they could make certain items more affordable in order to gain new customers. So his campaign is saying, well, he wasn't fixing prices, he was just providing all the data and analytics to allow somebody else to fix prices, I guess, under the guise of some corporate mantra. So you have this very real situation where cereal price fixing was a thing in the 70s and the 80s, probably the 90s, probably the 2000s. Bread pricing, it's all collusion amongst corporate entities. It happens. Nobody fucking cares. But can you imagine a world where you go to the grocery store and instead of having 19 brands that are the same thing, you just have one and it's cheap and there's no redundancy and you can focus productivity on something productive rather than having redundant cereal plants making the same shredded wheat?
Different label, same shredded wheat. Or maybe you can reduce capitalism to nothing in which you don't have to pay for food because it doesn't matter. You don't have to cut coupon, or like you said, clip coupons. You don't have to worry about things going on sale. You don't have to go to other stores, you know, because you want to get a better deal. It's so just wild the amount of energy that's wasted on maintaining capitalism and maintaining our quality of life when it comes to just caloric intake for survival.
And this concept of food, it scales to other products. You have building materials, you have apparel, you have clothing. At the end of the day, it's all functionally the same thing. And people run around trying to find deals at store A or store B so they can get, you know, a t-shirt that was made in Bangladesh in a factory by effectively slave labor. And at the end of the line, they either print the Adidas logo or the Nike logo. And you run around trying to find what the best deal is at a given store. Like, how does that add anything to anybody?
That adds zero value anywhere. And let's talk about what Peter Butterberry did wrong. The Butterbear? Butterbar. Old Petey. What Petey did wrong is he was so deep in analytics that he had to use Excel, or it was too big for Excel, and he had to run it on Bertha, which makes no fucking sense because Excel is just shithole tables. If you've ever used Excel, yuck.
He named his laptop Bertha.
That's so fucking stupid. What a fucking dickhead. Just the fucking worst type of person. I bet he thought it was cool, too.
Well, you thought it was so cool he, like, regurgitated this fact in an interview or in his book or some shit.
It's kind of like the Mitt Romney story when he talked about how his dog had diarrhea and shit all over the car because they made a makeshift plywood box to fucking torture their dog on family trips. It's like, if that's a good story, what the fuck? You're not a human.
And now he's the favorite Republican because he's going to vote for impeachment or some shit, right?
Or something fucking dumb, yeah. So we have Peter Butterberry. He has to run deep analytics. And you ask yourself, what does that mean? So you ask yourself, what kind of data do you think is available? So you have sales data, sure, and you have supply chain data. And I don't know why it's so hard to run this. Like, I was just doing that today. It's not that fucking tough. You have all this reported stuff in your...
You were fixing bread prices today?
I wasn't fixing bread prices, but I was doing some... Just doing analytics on some corporate data. It's not that tough to throw it within Excel and pivot tables and filters and all that stuff. You know, what he's implying is that he did system-level modeling, which I doubt he did, but if he really did system analysis on this and he had inputs and outputs and he was actually able to model a full economics model, it would be more than just a laptop to do.
Especially in the late 2000s. You need a lot of Berthas.
You need like a couple Berthas, right? He would need a whole plethora of Berthas.
Berthi.
But yeah, he would need, I would have to say, a Gibson. Probably even have to hack a Gibson and do that.
It's the Gibson. It's finding us too fast.
But I mean, a systems level model means that it's a temporal model. It has not only your input models, but all input models change in time. So it's a time series analysis. You'd have to iterate amongst a bunch of stuff to get bread prices, which makes no fucking sense why you'd even do that. So at the end of the day, what he did was basically useless. What he was arguing, which is what the campaign was saying, this is the most important part, is he was basically trying to manipulate prices so they can maximize margins.
But they wanted to make it more affordable.
They want to make it more affordable, which is bullshit. That means that they had to basically go in and target, using their monopoly status, competitors to drive them out of market. In areas in which there wasn't a lot of competitors, they're able to jack the prices up. That's literally what he was doing. So at the end of the day, when they say capitalism breeds, you know, all this nonsense about, you know, you have competition, all this fun shit, it's a lie. Because you have dickheads like Pete that go in and try to ruin it. Now, what else he should have done, which would have made things way easier, is if he wouldn't have went to a single supplier. What the collusion is nowadays, more modern version of this, is you have access to data from surveys conducted to all of your peer companies within your market. In layman's terms, what it is everybody willingly gives data to a third-party broker so that they can compile things like salaries together, so that if you're competing amongst retail stores, you know what the average retail person is worth so that you don't overpay your employee. The same thing happens with milk. You can do the same thing. These third parties go in and they go to all these stores and they survey the cost of milk and you get it back and go, oh wow, the average price of milk is $2.85 a gallon and I'm only charging $2.79. Guess I better bump my price up to $2.85 to be competitive. And now you've colluded with all your peers, but legally because it went through a third party. Because you didn't actively go out and actually collude. You're just using available data, which you can find in these model reports, which you can put your email in and get on certain websites, right? These reports and what the costs are. Or you just subscribe to it, right? You just subscribe to the cost in your area and you collude that way. And then when they ask you for data, you say, of course I'll give you my data because that's how the system works. As long as you give the data, your peer companies give data, and then you can all collude on things like wages, on costs, on supply chain, on shipping costs, all that shit. Legal price fixing.
So we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about the vaccine quickly, even though we've talked about this to some extent. But people have a real hard time understanding that vaccines are produced by companies.
Are you kidding me?
In manufacturing plants by human beings. And there's nothing special about a building with a Pfizer sign in front of it. You could take the literal building design and build another one and have people manufacture the vaccine in a second plant, and that would allow you to have two plants making the vaccine. Isn't that crazy?
Wait, how's that work?
But people have a really difficult time grasping that, oh, we have to let Pfizer do it because they know what they're doing. They know. And I mean, this is an example of capitalism clouding your mind. There's nothing unique about what Pfizer's doing. They've already done the engineering part. They've already built the physical buildings. They have a manufacturing process. This shit can be repeated again. And if they're not going to do it, somebody else should.
And it can be repeated again and again and again, because here's the dirty secret about manufacturing. Everything's written down. Literally written down. The suppliers of all the equipment, it's written down. The supply chain, written down. The raw materials, written down. The recipe, it's written down. It's all plugged into like your SCADA system, like in your MES. Like, it's literally in your MES. MES is a manufacturing execution system. It's designed to basically execute and essentially plan all of your resources across your entire company or plant. Essentially planned. You put in what you need, you put in your demands, you can put in your run rates, all that fun shit, your recipes, your inputs, your outputs, all that stuff, and you can coordinate efforts. You know what lines are going to be ran. You can coordinate times and shifts. Basically, essentially plan. And guess what? If Pfizer did that, which they did, anybody can seize the information. Because then you put it in your SCADA system. Supervisory control and data acquisition. That system is what you would then coordinate all of your lines with. So your ERP system, your enterprise resource planner, can bring in all that information and literally run your entire plant manufacturing. I know this because of manufacturing. It's not that hard to do. You can literally seize this centrally planted in the White House, if you wanted to, in the Oval Office, and get on screens and HMIs and plan every single pharma plant in the entire country if you wanted to.
So the entire concept of resource scarcity associated with the vaccine is an artifact of capitalism. It is an engineering or technical problem that is not solvable. We have the capability to manufacture anything and any quantity. We're just choosing not to.
Yes, we're choosing to allow profits to dominate, like, people every single day. Because things like, you know, we want to vaccinate our healthcare workers, and we want to vaccinate our children getting back to school and all these things. You know, we want to vaccinate the most vulnerable, etc. Like, all of that's possible if we would have just literally ramped production hard.
Our literal first episode, like, 10 months ago, was about making more N95 masks by making more plants.
Yep. It's not going away.
And have they done that yet?
Not really. I think they just squeezed another 10-15% out of plants. I mean, by this point in time, they probably are. In fact, that's why you see a bunch of those KN95s kicking around. The Chinese have ramped up their production. And so does India. That's actually what scared me in the beginning, was that both China and India had large manufacturings of our PPEs, and both were vulnerable because they didn't necessarily have a coordinated medical response, except that China did and India did too. So, you know, I was also susceptible to brainwashing at that point in time too, just thinking about scarcity. India much more, because they are a lot denser in some of the manufacturing areas and a little scarier on supply chain. But guess what? We made it through, and India didn't wipe themselves out, because they actually would ink your arm. I don't know if you've seen videos. If you needed to quarantine, they marked you. And if you were seen in public, guess what happened to you? You were arrested, taken home. Like, there is no bullshit in India. There's no bullshit in China. Like, those two locked it down. And guess what happened? They don't have that many deaths.
They can go outside now.
They can go outside and hang out. And they can make PPE for the rest of the assholes who didn't want to lock down.
Sending kids back to school during a pandemic.
Gross.
There's a good picture circulating the internet where Joe Biden is getting interviewed by Nora O'Donnell of CBS News. And they're, like, sitting 20 feet apart in a completely desolate room with mic booms and overhead lighting. And Joe says,
I think it's time for schools to reopen safely. Safely. You have to have fewer people in the classroom. You have to have ventilation systems that have been reworked. Our CDC commissioner is going to be coming out with science-based judgment within, I think, as early as Wednesday, as to lay out what the minimum requirements are.
So the underlying premise as to why kids need to get back to school is that parents need to get back to work. This is, again, not a technological problem. It's a political problem that needs to be solved so that we can reopen our economy, which is what the ruling class wants.
And I find it really ironic that it takes a pandemic to try to upgrade 70-year-old schools. Think about the baby boomers. A lot of the square, brutalistic buildings that you see that are just ugly fucking square buildings, they're schools. There's modern ones built in the 90s. There was a resurgence in the 90s, but a lot of the old schools that you see were built in the 50s, baby boomers. Right? When you see things like, we got to put in, you know, better ventilation, you know how hard it is to put in ventilation in a school that already exists? I mean, if you're listening to this and you do, you know, any type of sheet metal or mechanical work, you know that taking out, like, ceiling panels and trying to rerun and fix a bunch of shit is not an easy task. Like, what they're saying is just blowing smoke up people's asses. There's just no way. Like, it's insane to think that. I mean, yeah, you can put up barriers. That's fine. You can put in UVC air filters, I guess. I mean, UVC also has a path length dependency and also has a time dependency, too, which I haven't seen any guidance on. So UVC is one of the spectrums in which it destroys the RNA. mRNA? What is that? RNA-based thing? So it's like 20 minutes at a certain lumens. So basically, like, sun on, like, a hot summer day in the sun is, like, I think takes 20 minutes to kill the virus or something wild.
The amount of time depends on where you're at on Earth and what angle the sun hits the atmosphere and whether the UVC is filtered in the atmosphere or not.
So if you don't want to wait 20 minutes, you have to pump in more UVC energy than on a hot-ass summer day, like at noon, into these things to kill it.
So from a science perspective, Joe's right that we have the ability to send kids back to school safely. But can you just retrofit an old ventilation system at a 50s school with a new UVC filter box thing and it just works? There are very real technological issues that need to be overcome on a case-by-case, school-by-school basis in order for this to be viable. Let's say you wanted to install a UVC light filter, and you had everything else, and all you had to do was hook up this box. Well, that box is going to need to be a different size. It's going to have different characteristics for every individual heating system, because guess what? Schools aren't centrally planned. Every school is going to have a different heating system. It's going to vary by county, by state. Depends on how old they are. Depends on who has the contract to maintain it. It's going to be expensive. There also isn't just a giant warehouse of UVC filters sitting around. We can't make vaccines. We can't make masks. We're certainly not going to start mass producing UVC furnace filters or air cleaners or any of that. But by next Wednesday, we're going to be safe.
Well, let's talk about a few fundamental issues with the idea of reopening any building with circulation. Okay, one, a lot of times ceiling diffusers come from the top, right? Nobody has ran a CFD, computational fluid dynamics modeling, to look for where the flow patterns would be anywhere in the room. What happens if you put in barriers? You don't know any of that stuff, right? And I'm being overly technical here, but you also don't know what the recirculation of any room is. So we retrofit this thing, but guess what? The science labs don't have enough recirculation, and it's just basically a COVID-like sauna in there.
It's stagnant air, and it never gets recycled.
Right? Why? Well, they didn't want to have air blowing on a Bunsen burner, so they taped it off. Well, there you go. Now you've defeated the entire purpose of the UVC filters. Let's talk about N95 wear. N95 absorbs into the mask the particles, right? It physically absorbs and blocks it. And that means that as soon as you touch the front of the mask, you have to assume it is contaminated, which means that as soon as you take and doff the N95, you throw it away and get a new one on there. That's $1 per mask, $2 per mask. So kids will have to sit there with the N95 mask on the entire day, or they have to replace it like every hour. And once they get wet, you know, if they have any type of facial hair or anything on their face or makeup or whatever, it deems them less efficient. So teachers who have beards are going to have to shave their entire face in order to wear these N95 masks, which is fine. And how do you clean, right? It takes 10 minutes for commercial non-bleach-based cleaners to kill the virus. So do you walk around and spray every booth the kids are sitting at? Do you put bleach everywhere? You do it in between classes? It's high school, so where are the kids going to go to? Are they going to stay in the same classroom all day?
We're going to put all the kids in the hallway while we clean. Cleaning and healthy facilities is referenced as one of the 5 strategies in the new guidance the CDC released on Friday, February 12th, but the general plan is incredibly vacuous. For cleaning, the directive is regularly clean frequently touch surfaces within the school and on school buses at least daily or between use as much as possible. The reference to ventilation in the guidance, even though Joe said it had to be reworked, is literally improve ventilation to the extent possible, such as by opening windows and doors to increase circulation of outdoor air to increase the delivery of clean air and dilute potential contaminants. The guidance is literally open a window. The main premise of the guidance is a toggle between in-person school or virtual school based on a community spread threshold. The main tools are masking and social distancing. There is zero requirement for teacher vaccinations. It's effectively just saying it's safe to go back to school because we wrote a document saying it was safe to go back to school. Promise kept.
We don't have a party that's in power that can demand retrofitting schools or demand seizing the vaccine or doing anything any other major country would do that's socialist in nature. China and India are pumping out vaccines. They don't care. They have to. You know, people are making money, but it's controlled. It's not like it's a free-for-all in the capital market, which is also weird to me, too, because the government made contracts with people, but then they don't really enforce the contracts. And because it's not centrally planned, you have things like empty vaccination centers or not enough vaccines given out to one area, but more given out to other areas. It's a very fucked up, you know, deployment. It makes no sense to me.
It's totally ad hoc and inefficient. People like to say that, oh, well, the Pfizer vaccine it's not government funded. And it's like, well, I mean, it is, but at the same time, yes, Pfizer did not take research money from the government. They entered into a contract with the government, said, we will buy 300 million doses. I don't know what the number is, but we will buy some number of doses at a fixed price. And that's your contract. So now Pfizer can say, oh, we have a contract that's worth X amount of money, so we can take that money and pour it into research to make a vaccine that we then turn around and sell to you. The cost model of the contract literally is government money given to Pfizer. It's framed as we're exchanging a good for another good, but the research cost is baked into the final product cost. So the government funded Pfizer indirectly to make the vaccine. That's where the money comes from.
And it goes back to everything in this episode. You know, we hate neoliberalism. We hate anything associated with capitalism. And that's where we talk about, you know, post-capitalism stress disorder. It's hard for us to talk to any of our neighbors or colleagues about what it would look like if we just seized the vaccine. What would it look like? We gave you what it would look like, but nobody understands fundamentally what it is. The closest thing we have is the Defense Production Act. And so they forced companies to make ventilators.
You're not seizing the means of production. You're paying a company to make shit.
You're forcing them to make it, but you're compensating them.
Yes.
It, right? It's still a neoliberal construct. It's still capitalism. It's still nonsense, which we're still relying on private entities. It's not like the government is going out and seizing Ford's ventilator division, which doesn't exist, but I guess they had to.
They did it for a while, I guess. I don't.
And ventilators weren't even helpful. They use CPAP machines in the future, so whatever. At least they tried. I don't know. Anyways, that's the closest you have. As an example, I mean, it's surely just, it's just nuts. It doesn't make any fucking sense. I like saying those words because think about it. It doesn't make any sense. But you have to tell somebody that what they believe is stupid. If you did, think about the atheist that you know or the non-atheist, and you're trying to tell them that believing in God is fucking dumb. How hard is that to tell somebody, right? Or that watching organized sports is a waste of your fucking time. But it's cognitive dissonance, right? You can only push somebody so far before they just push back because you're disrupting their entire belief system. And that's why it's really important, especially when we talk on this show, to understand the material conditions of individuals. If somebody, again, has put 30 years into a union job and they believe the union's good and they believe that there's no problems, we believe the unions are good, but we believe there's also problems. We believe capitalism is bad, but yet they spent their entire life fighting for their shithole house or whatever semblance of their reality is. They're not going to want to give that up. So you have to bite off in small chunks and teach them and show them what it would be like. You know, what happens if we fund everybody to have their own urban garden? Right? What happens if we funded it and gave out, everybody got water filters so you can get rid of PFOAs in your water or Flint, right? I mean, that's a real life thing that could happen. Everybody filters their own water and the city also filters their water. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but those are just real life examples you could have. You know, what if instead of Uber and Lyft existing, there was another transportation that's owned by the city?
We could call it public transportation.
Yeah, the public could transport. Yeah. You know, what if instead of taxi cab companies, the city ran their own taxis? Whoa, right?
Crazy talk,
right? But think about what you would do with the profits. You have two choices. You can either take the profits and put it into the coffers and use it for other public good, or you can decide to decrease the price so that the individual rider doesn't have to pay as much to ride. Those are the two options you have, or split the difference.
And there's plenty of cities that have literal free public transportation because they've determined that large-scale free public transportation increases economic spending, which is incurred through sales tax and stuff like that. So the city actually makes more money as a result of making public transportation free.
Yeah, whoa, that's crazy. What if the health department really actually was a health department and had primary care doctors and did everything that you wanted to at the doctors instead of it being like just like a hellhole you have to go to when you want to get a vaccine? Like, these are all crazy things, but this is what post-capitalism stress disorder does to you. It limits your ability to think outside the box. It's like, what's that Chomsky book?
Manufacturing Consent.
Manufacturing Consent is exactly what it is. Thank you for helping my brain out, right? Where you limit the argument to two things or three things instead of actually what it could be.
One last final note on the schools is that Biden advocates for all these great things to make schools safer and cleaner and better and kids will learn more gooder. But at the end of the day, we have kids that are in schools today that are in lunch money debt. They literally don't have money to pay for lunch. Why don't we use common sense and just pay for shit that kids need, like lunch? So forgive me if I'm incredulous that Biden's going to do anything to make schools safer until he addresses the lunch debt situation.
That or any of the social economic despair that puts people in lunch debt, right? The idea that kids even have to pay for lunch is fucking crazy to me. Again, I keep saying that phrase. It's so wild to me. Make every school a Title I school, which means that everybody gets free lunch and free breakfast. A Title I district is any district that has more than 70% of its occupants in poverty.
Means testing is bullshit.
Literally remove that chunk of it. That's all you have to do. Because not everybody's going to want to eat a shitty bowl of, like, Frosted Flakes in the morning in, like, a shitty hot dog with, like, nasty-ass French fries. But I guarantee some people would, and it would benefit a lot of working-class families if they didn't have to pay $3 a plate for their kids when it's school time. Bougie-ass schools, no one's going to want to eat the fucking flat pizza or the corn or the shitty salad bar. No one's going to want to do that. But guess what? In the non-poor areas, but still working-class areas, they're going to eat the shit out of that, and that'll help tremendously. So again, we know everything we talked about is like at the national level, but what we're trying to do in the show is show you how, talk about how there are real issues at the national level, and there are real concerns like PCSD, which is the primary part of the show, the post-capitalism stress disorder. What's important that is that we still fight locally, because every one of these can be bitten off into a small chunk at the local level. You can still go and influence the school district not to send your kids back until it's safe. Not to fall trap with conservative assholes who say, we got to get our kids back to school. Why? Because he owns a roofing company. He wants to go exploit labor. And he can't because people are still at home. We don't want people making more money on unemployment than when they go to work. Well, fucking pay them more then.
Is that your conservative voice?
Is it? Yeah, do I sound like an asshole? Does that sound cool? What do I sound like? Like an old white man? Is that what I'm trying to sound like?
We'll fix it in post, and we'll make sure that the kids get off your lawn.
It's my frisbee now. Kids still play a frisbee?
Yeah, I don't know what a frisbee is.
It's my flying golf disc. Football. Go play disc golf somewhere else, hippie.
There's probably an opportunity to rebrand the frisbee as like a right wing thing and just sell them in copious amounts. It's a freedom disc. Thanks for listening to our podcast.
Okay. So again, we have this global mindset, we have a national mindset, but it really needs to be think locally, act locally, right? And what you can do is what we need. We really need just whatever efforts you can get out and do. That's what the society needs. Yeah, so it's also important to remember that whether something is good or bad is not predicated on whether something is profitable. And that's the neoliberal mindset, is that the only reason and only way we can do something for you is if it's profitable, like Tom's shoes. It's only profitable because you buy a $95 pair of $20 shoes and they give a free one out and they take your $90 and they make $50 in profit. That's it. It doesn't mean they're a good company because there's no ethical presumption of capitalism. So again, you can think globally, but really it's think locally, act locally. A couple examples. HOAs. Most of the time they should be torn down. They fucking suck because they're basically a slush fund for people that control the HOAs. And HOAs were developed right after World War II to prevent black soldiers from utilizing the GI Bill. So your goal is to try to tear down your HOA. Unless you love it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know anybody that likes their HOA.
Yeah, fuck them. They're just a bunch of dickheads. Read your bylaws. And then sue them when they violate your bylaws in your covenant. And then get out of your land contract with them. Same thing with charities. Really investigate if a local charity is an actual charity that does anything, or if it's just a slush fund for wealthy people for tax donations to try to influence local politics through, you know, tax write-offs. This is super important. There are a lot of charities out there that interact with your city councils that aren't actually charities. They're basically just working groups of people with money. And the other question you should ask is things like community events that are funded by for-profit places like expos or community garage sales, in which somebody is making money off of registration fees. Like, somebody's making money off your table, and what's the benefit there? These are all things, if you can investigate them and start asking questions, it really freaks people out.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.